Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB 19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!
Without further ado, I would like to invite Ed to come and speak to us about bronchiolitis. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Damien. No, that's all right. Thanks, Damien. I'm Ed Oakley. I'm an emergency physician who has to call myself a paediatric emergency physician from now, because I haven't seen adults for 20 years. So if I go and work in an adult department, I'm sure I'll kill someone. So I'm a paediatric emergency physician from Melbourne. I'm a clinician by background. I'll call myself a clinician, and I have an interest in research. And I think both from the Peruki session and from this session from Predict, I think you'll see that the unique thing about paediatric emergency medicine research is almost all of the research is controlled, run, performed by the clinicians, not by researchers who are outside the clinical field. My talk is going to be about a story of a series of research projects that Predict has done around bronchiolitis. The story starts before Predict even was in existence, which you heard from Meredith yesterday, which was about 2004. This is a picture of where I live, east of Melbourne. This is on the road down to my house, which is down in the gully in the trees. I think this picture is important to me because every morning on my way out, on my way to work, it might take me an hour and a half to get to work, and an hour and a half to get home, I get to go past this, and I get to pause and lift my eyes and look into the distance. And I think that's something that to me is very important, being able to stop in the middle of a busy clinical shift, in the middle of trying to work out what's going wrong with this research trial, why aren't we recruiting patients, to be able to pause and look beyond where we currently are and think, okay, life isn't quite so bad. I can see my staff down there working who are actually all enjoying the shift, even though I think it's a crap shift. They're having a good time, so maybe I need to move on. So this story starts in about the year 2000. We had a fellow who was training in paediatric emergency medicine in Switzerland come out with us for 3 years. He'd been with us for about a year, and he said, I don't understand. And I said, well, I gathered that, but yeah, what's the problem? He said, I don't understand why in kids with bronchiolitis, you put all these drips in and you almost never give them their fluid with a nasogastric tube. Whereas in Switzerland, where I came from, we would just not even think of putting a drip in this little kid with bronchiolitis. I said, that's really interesting. So he went away and spoke to his friends and I spoke to my friends, and we realised there was this big difference in what we did. And we didn't understand why. I was told you'd kill kids if you put nasogastric tubes in them when they had bronchiolitis. And he was told, well, why would you try and stick a drip in when it's so hard? At the same time as this, you know, while we were still having this discussion, Predict was being formed. And so Predict got formed. The next steps were Predict decided it needed to understand a little bit about what we did as clinicians in Australia and New Zealand. So we did some network studies. One of those network studies was a study looking at bronchiolitis management. Now at this time, and it was published in 2008, but it was done in 2005. At that time, across Australia and New Zealand, 50% of the patients got nasogastric tubes and 50% got intravenous therapy when they needed hydration. There was a large variation in sites from 70% nasogastric to 20% nasogastric. So there was a degree of equipoise for us, which made it good for our trial. At the same time, we were still planning what we were going to do about trying to work out what was the best or the right thing to do for these children. It took us a little while, but we did eventually get some funding to do a trial, which we ran in 7 centres. It was the first interventional trial that Predict did. We randomised kids who needed admission to hospital with bronchiolitis and who needed non-oral hydration. We randomised them to have either IV hydration or nasogastric hydration. Many of you may have seen this data. It's published a while ago. Our primary outcome was length of stay. There was no difference in length of stay. So we said, well, one's as good as the other from our point of view. However, there were a number of secondary outcomes that we thought were important. The most important one we thought was, how difficult is it to institute the therapy that we've chosen? You can see from the slide, it's much more difficult to institute intravenous therapy. And in fact, there were 56 children who could not have intravenous therapy started, compared with zero children who could not have nasogastric therapy started. So that was interesting for us. We said, well, they're equal. They're equal therapies, but take this into account. So once we got those results and we thought, OK, that's really good, what do? We decided to move on and do some further research with that patient population. Now, yesterday there was a bit of a discussion about how do we involve trainees in our research. Well, we had four trainees who were looking for research projects. And we said, fantastic, we've got this population of patients. We enrolled 760 patients in our study. However, there were nearly 4,000 patients that we screened. So three of those students then went and collected data on the rest of the patients, all those who we missed, who refused to be in the study, et cetera, et cetera. So they then went and collected patients. So we now had actually 3,500 patients in our database. We did a series of studies that they were interested in. One of them had just been in neonates for a year, and he said, I noticed when I was in neonates that at the start of my year, every kid with bronchiolitis got IV therapy. At the end of my year, at least half of them had a nasogastric. I said, that is really interesting, because our study excluded kids less than 2 months of age. So are we actually changing practice in a patient population that was not in our study? Don't know, we'll find out. So we did this study in neonates, and we showed that at this time, 70% of patients were getting nasogastric therapy. So we had changed practice in a population that was outside the population. We looked in our hospital, at the Children's Hospital in Melbourne, at all of the others, and at least 80% of those were getting nasogastric therapy. So without any effort, we had changed practice across these sites. We moved on to look at medication. And there's been a fair bit of talk about bronchiolitis and what works and what doesn't work over the last few days. We know the medication doesn't work. There's good evidence to show it doesn't help. Therefore, I take that to say I shouldn't give it. But we decided, let's wait and see what we do. So we looked at medication in ours. We looked at a number of things, inhaled therapies, salbutamol, Atrovent, hypertonic saline and adrenaline, and oral or parenteral therapies of antibiotics and steroids. What we found is we used a lot of medication. There was a lot of variation amongst sites. Between 27 and 47% of patients, depending on the site, got some medication, at least one of those medications. You can see there that from 4 months to 12 months, there was a linear increase in the amount of medication used, and most of that was salbutamol. We thought, it's probably we're not as good at doing this as we thought we should be. So we know what we do, and we know what we should do. How do we bridge that gap? How do we jump the chasm? We decided one way to do that, or one thing we needed to do as part of that, was to create an agreed bi-national guideline, which is available on our website there. Now, I'm not going to talk more about the guideline or our translation work. Stuart's going to do that in his talk in a few minutes. So we'll hear more about that issue. But we're going to push forward with the rest of our studies in bronchiolitis. The third study we did was of the patients who went to intensive care, what was the respiratory support that they got? We were surprised, although anecdotally we probably weren't surprised, but the magnitude of the change in the use of high flow surprised us. There was a threefold increase in the use of high flow. Of all respiratory support in the intensive care unit, it went from being 24% to 54% of all respiratory support in our intensive care units. We thought, well, that's a big change. Anecdotally, that was starting to happen in the rest of the hospitals. Some hospitals weren't using it all. So we then thought, well, okay, well, What does this mean? So we collaborated with the critical care research group in the Children's Hospital in Queensland, and we decided to do a randomised controlled trial of high-flow nasal oxygen therapy, or high-flow nasal cannula therapy, and standard subnasal oxygen therapy, called the Paris trial. And many of you will have seen the results of this. None of the data that I'm presenting you at the moment is new data. It's all been available for some time. But it's all part of our meandering along trying to improve the care of bronchiolitis. What did we find? This is an infographic that Don't Forget the Bubbles created, or part of the infographic. Saved me creating my own. Thank you. You can see we recruited 1,400 patients, equal numbers in each group. The primary outcome was escalation of care. It was a complex outcome. I'm not going to go into the details of the outcome now because it's not that important. You can see more patients who had standard oxygen therapy needed care escalated, twice as many. The number needed to treat with high flow was 9 to prevent one patient needing escalation of therapy. What does that mean? Well, it's interesting. Of that 167 patients who had standard oxygen therapy, who failed standard oxygen therapy, 100% or 167 all went to high flow. And the majority of those only needed high flow. So the number needed to treat of 9 means I need to start 9 patients on high flow to prevent one patient on low flow getting high flow. I said, well, it's hard to get my head around that. What does that mean? To me, it doesn't mean very much at all. But we'll continue to move on, I think. We also, in that study, looked at other secondary outcomes that we thought were important. We looked at complications of therapy. We looked at the need to go to the intensive care, the length of time in the intensive care, and the length of stay in hospital. There was no difference in any outcome between starting on standard oxygen therapy of 2 litres, up to 2 litres per minute. Our study enrolled only hypoxemic children. So you had to have a saturation that in your institution said, you now need to give oxygen. There's a complication that we couldn't get agreement amongst all the institutions of what that was. So in some institutions that was 94%, in some institutions it was 92%, and in some it was 90%. So we lived with that. That's a real world application of high flow. We were grappling with what this outcome meant. When you look at the raw numbers, the number needed to treat of 9, twice as many failures, say everyone needs to get high flow. But it's hard to interpret the data that way when all the low flow people graduate to high flow when they fail low flow. So this is unpublished data to date. We decided that what we need to do is to look at what other evidence there is in high flow use. And there has been some other trials that have happened in the time frame since we made our guideline. There are 4 RCTs of 1,800 patients. Remember, one of those is our RCT, which had nearly 1,500. So the others are small studies. One of the RCTs I'm not going to talk about because its standard group in no way mirrored standard therapy in our group, so I'm going to leave it out. One of them was in the emergency department, and one of them was in the intensive care unit. But we're going to talk about all of these. This slide, this has been submitted for publication, this stuff. It's been accepted, just not available yet. This slide, the top study is a study done in John Hunter Hospital in New South Wales in Australia that randomised 200 kids to high flow, standard flow. Their standard flow, 33% of their patients failed. Our standard flow, 27% of our patients failed. And as you can see, successful rescue by high flow was about 61% in both studies. So they all graduated to high flow, and most of those only needed high flow. Some then needed to go to ICU, and some needed further respiratory therapy as well. The Malesi study, which is the ICU study, showed that if you are in high flow in ICU and you fail, you'll be rescued in the majority of cases by CPAP. If you're in CPAP in ICU and you fail, you'll be rescued in 82% of patients by high flow. So, okay, it's a very confusing. So what does all this mean? My takeaway message about high flow is that I don't think yet there is any evidence to show that high flow should be used as the primary therapy for patients with bronchiolitis. The other thing to say about the first study from John Hunter is that they excluded all patients with a saturation of less than 90. We included all of those patients in ours. So whether you have higher saturations or lower saturations, the outcome is the same. So we shouldn't be using high flow in patients that need oxygen first. We should be starting with low flow. If they fail, and there are various measures of failure, and you can choose the one that fits your organisation best, if they fail, they should graduate to high flow, and a few of them will fail high flow and need further therapy. So that's my take. When I lift my eyes from the quagmire of patients that exist in my emergency department at now, it's the middle of winter in Melbourne, with bronchiolitis, and I have 15 high flow machines, I like to just go and take them all away and say, you know, once you start therapy, it's very hard to stop. It's hard to get people to turn it off. So we've got to try and stop it getting put on in the first place. As we heard from here, we've still got some research that we're doing with the Canadians on bronchiolitis, looking at adrenaline and dexamethasone in combination for the treatment of bronchiolitis, or trying to prevent admission or allow earlier discharge. So our story with bronchiolitis hasn't finished. I'm sure it will one day, hopefully before I retire. But it's been a nice journey, and I think it's a story of how research can influence our practice in managing a disease. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Ed. So one of the things I was thinking is going as you were going through that is, what is the practical problem that we all face, especially in the emergency department, but I'm sure it's on the wards, is how do you know when you need to intervene if someone needs escalation? So the example I would give is, if a little one comes in and clinically has bronchiolitis and may have slightly low sats, you put on some oxygen. When do you know that is failing, so that you know you need to go onto high flow?
Yeah, and there is a little bit of evidence that helps us decide that. The expectation is that high flow will improve their physiological parameters. It's not about how they look, it's about the patient. So we would expect that within 3 to 4 hours. Some people will say 2 hours, but you've got to give it some time to work. So if you're on low flow, you will say, we expect your oxygen saturation will improve, your heart rate will come down, your respiratory rate will come down. If those things aren't happening, you're remaining hypoxic, your heart rate's going up or not changing, your respiratory rate's going up or not changing, then you can say, okay, perhaps we need to escalate this therapy, especially if they remain hypoxic.
Fantastic. Do we have any questions from the floor? I've got another question. So you very subtly added in this change in practice just because another study is going on. What do you think drove the use of nasogastric tubes in the less than 2 month group? What was the mechanism by which that happened, do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting that I think the many of the people in the places that had gone to the neonatal units were working in the hospitals where we were recruiting the patients. So they'd been involved in the study. So they had awareness of the study. I think they knew the outcomes of the study. And I think the reason we moved to nasogastric is the nurses put the nasogastric in, the doctors put the IV in, so the doctors say, I want a nasogastric. That, I might be being cynical, but I think that is a reasonable amount of our driver to remove the nasogastric therapy.
That was my feeling as well, and it's nice to have had that validated externally. Fantastic. Okay, any further questions? Oh, Felix, actually, have we got a microphone? Just, right, we're missing a, shout out Felix, and up, yep.
What you
Yeah, okay. So, the
difference between, if you've got a sick bronc, who makes the decision on sick? How do we make sure that the inter-rater reliability is the same?
And I think the answer to that is to keep it based in physiological parameters. It's not about how much the ribs are sucking in. Because what you think is severe worker breathing is not what I think is severe worker breathing. It's about the effect it is having on the patient. So if the patient's not hypoxemic, not tachycardic, not specifically, you know, significantly tachypneic, then they're fine. You don't need to do anything. So once they become hypoxemic, we need to put some oxygen on and just watch. And it's about allowing time for the change to happen. Nothing happens fast in bronchiolitis. You're not going to die in the next half an hour just because you're a bit hypoxic. Put some oxygen on and spend a little bit of time waiting to see what the response is. And I think people don't like waiting and watching. So I would just encourage everyone to stare off into the distance for a little while. Just step back from where you are.
Nothing happens fast in bronchiolitis. I love that as a quote. Thank you very much, Ed.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!